Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has developed a new long-range cruise missile. The European Union has approved the 10th package of sanctions against Russia on the anniversary of the war in Ukraine. Also coming up, Palestinians hold massive street rallies across the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip in protest at Israel's deadly raid on Nablus. Our top story, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has developed a new cruise missile with a range of over 1,600 kilometers. The commander of the IRGC's aerospace force says the missile is dubbed after the city of Parvez to honor the martyrs of the Kurdistan province. Brigadier General Amir Ali Hajizadeh made the comment in an interview on the national broadcaster. He said Iran now possesses hypersonic missiles which no air defense system may ever be able to intercept. The general said all missiles Iran is now producing are precision strike weapons. The country has made quick advancements in its missile program in recent years. Tehran, however, has repeatedly stressed that its missile program is purely defensive and meant for deterrence. The European Union approves a 10th package of sanctions on Russia on the first anniversary of the war in Ukraine. The EU presidency is calling the sanctions the most forceful and far-reaching against Russia ever. The package includes tighter export restrictions as well as measures against entities supporting the war. The US has also imposed new sanctions on Russia, primarily targeting banks and the defense industry. Washington and its allies have imposed a volley of sanctions on Russia since the war began last February. But the policy has backfired and caused a surge in food and fuel prices across the US and Europe. 1 year on, the war between Russia and Ukraine is showing no signs of slowing down. The battles are now most intense in the east, including in the Donetsk region. Russia says it has killed nearly 240 Ukrainian soldiers during assaults there in the past 24 hours. Earlier, the deputy chief of the Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, said Russia must win the war. Medvedev added that one of Moscow's goals is to push back threats at the country's borders, even as far away as Poland's frontiers. In turn, the Ukrainian president has pledged to do everything to defeat Russia this year. Turning elsewhere, tensions remain high in the occupied West Bank after Israel's deadly raid on the city of Nablus last week. In a show of strength and unity, Palestinians have taken to the streets in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip to condemn the incursion. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program.
On this segment of the program, thousands of Palestinians have poured into the streets across the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip in protest at Israel's deadly raid on Nablus. The rallies came following an earlier call by the Palestinian resistance group Lion's Den. It urged Palestinians to take to the streets to show the world The resistance is ready to give a rapid response to any Israeli aggression. Ismail Haniyeh, who heads the political bureau of Hamas resistance movement, issued a message lauding the massive street rallies. He said the people of Palestine and the resistance front will not allow anybody to stop the ongoing anti-Israeli uprising across the West Bank. Nearly a dozen Palestinians were killed and more than 100 were injured in the Israeli forces' Wednesday raid on the city of Nablus. A 22-year-old Palestinian youth identified as Mohammad Jawabara also died early Friday. He succumbed to injuries suffered earlier on Thursday during an Israeli attack on Al-Arub refugee camp in the city of Al-Khanil. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Mona Candy, who's joining us from Ramallah. Also, we have journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes, who's joining us from Belfast. Welcome to the program. To the both of you, let's start off with Mona. Bring us up to speed on the recent Palestinian rallies that have taken place across the occupied West Bank and also in the besieged Gaza Strip in protest at Israel's deadly raids that have taken place over the past 2 days, most notably the one that took place in Nablus.
We can say that there was kind of a quick response by such demonstrations and protests following the Israeli massacre that was carried out in Nablus, left 10 Palestinians or 11 Palestinians killed in Nablus city, and over 100 Palestinians were wounded. At least two members of the newly created Palestinian resistance group, the Lions, then were also murdered in Nablus city by the Israeli forces. The Lions Den group called on the Palestinians to go to the street to express their anger and to tell the world that the reprisal and the response would be quick, not only from the Lions Den, but also from all the resistance groups. And this is what happened. Thousands of Palestinians flocked to the streets in Ramallah, in Tul Karim, in Al Khalil, in areas around Al Quds like Shafat and Qalandia refugee camp. In the Gaza Strip, Palestinians were reunited on one thing, that they follow and support the resistance, that the call, the urgent call by the Lions Den for all the Palestinians were responded after midnight to tell the Israeli is one thing, that Palestinians are still adherent to the choice of resistance, that the Israeli crimes would have a serious response from the Palestinians, but the Palestinians are waiting maybe for the appropriate response and the planning for the appropriate response. 11 Palestinians were killed and their blood is very precious for the Palestinians. Of course, one day after this massacre, a general strike was declared. A day of anger was declared on Thursday, as well as today, Friday. Demonstrations and protests had taken place all across the occupied West Bank, and a number of Palestinians were wounded because of confrontations that took place as well.
Steve, with you, how do you explain the international silence with regards to the day-to-day crimes that are being carried out by the Israelis? And also, how can this status quo ever change given the unequivocal support of the likes of the United States?
Well, I personally believe that all the people involved in the political kind of elite in the West, in Western Europe and in America, which only makes up 13% of the world's population, although the 1% in the West makes up 50%. Of the world's wealth. You also have the kingdoms of Saudi Arabia and some of the Gulf states created after the Sykes-Picot Agreement by Britain and France to act as their vassal states, to act as parties that would divide the Ummah and divide Arab and Persian states in a continuing, tumbling, falling sectarian kind of quagmire that prevents people coming together. There will be no change on the ground. The resistance and the axis of resistance are possibly the only people who can de facto change things going forward. I think the Israelis are in a very, very, very strong position. And yet we saw the fall of the Berlin Wall, and sometimes a week in the politics can be a very long time and things can change quickly. So let's pray that Palestinians will get be treated with dignity and equality and given the nationhood and sovereignty that they so much deserve, and that the pariah state of Israel, because we're moving in the multipolar world, it may be possible that it won't be the West, it won't be America, it could be Latin America, it could be Russia, it could be Iran, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Africa, which brings Israel to account, because no one in the West, none of the politicians that are bought and paid for by the Zionist dollar, have any interest in protecting Arab, Palestinian, Persian rights in West Asia.
Thanks a lot, Damono Candiel, joining us from Ramallah. Also thanks to journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes, joining us from Belfast.
Moving on, Lebanon is grappling with the fallout of an economic crisis. Food insecurity in the country, home to over 5 million people, is among the consequences of the crisis. Our correspondent in Beirut has a report.
At one of Lebanon's local supermarkets, only a few items cost a bundle of Lebanese pounds. The country's cost of living crisis is taking a heavy toll on people, as 80,000 lira equal only $1. As Lebanon enters a third year of a deepening economic crisis, basic necessities like food and medicine have become more expensive than ever before. It has become almost a daily struggle for some families to put food on the table.
The Western sanctions on the one hand and domestic corruption on the other hand have been affecting the situation, and it is the people who are suffering.
Many blame those in power for heeding to U.S. and Western control of monetary activity. People on the street say the increasing rate of the dollar is a major contributor to the crisis.
If the dollar became high, 1,000, the items more and more. Not the real price. And you can see this in other supermarkets. You go, one supermarket is cheaper than others, and around 20,000-30,000. Why? So they don't, no control should be controlled, because really nobody can afford many things now in the supermarkets because it's high prices.
God help the families who have children and are in need of basic items like milk and yogurt. Bread has become 10 times more expensive. Even onions are not affordable now, and everything is in dollar.
Currency depreciation and the lifting of subsidies have resulted in a dramatic rise in prices of medicine as well, adding to the problems of a deteriorating Lebanese economy. Lebanon's national currency has lost now more than 90% of its value. Many believe that as long as imports are priced in U.S. dollars, which controls the market, there is very little hope for economic recovery. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The death toll from the landslides and floods that hit Brazil's southeast last week has risen to 57. Only one of the deaths has been reported outside the city of São Sebastião. Rescue operations are still underway in the affected areas in the state of São Paulo, as dozens remain missing. According to local officials, more than 4,000 people have been forced to leave their homes. Tourists have also been urged to refrain from traveling to the cities in the region as more rainfall is expected. Brazil has been hit by a series of disasters triggered by extreme weather conditions in recent years. Flooding killed hundreds in the country last year. The 38th edition of the Fejr International Music Festival has wrapped up in the capital, Tehran. The week-long festival is considered the most prestigious music events in Iran, as it brings together musicians, artists, music bands, and enthusiasts in the Iranian capital every year. Gisu Misha Ahmadi has more details.
A night of fun and music with the exceptional performance of the St. Petersburg Ensemble, followed by classical pieces by Tehran's Symphonic Orchestra. This is how the 38th edition of the FAJ International Music Festival wrapped up a week of orchestral, traditional, and pop performances. Aside from the outstanding performances, the event did not fail to celebrate the best of the best, with the prestigious Barbat Prize awarded in four different sections, this time also awarded to Iranian folk music.
The 38th edition of the FAJ Music Festival was very special in terms of the large number of folk music pieces that were performed, and the special award that was given to the musicians in this genre.
I'm honored to have won this prize. I've been working very hard and I'm extremely overwhelmed right now.
This year, over 2,000 Iranian and foreign musicians, including 30 music bands, gathered in the capital to present their latest musical compositions in seven concert halls in Tehran and several others in over a dozen provinces.
The Fajr Music Festivals this time was even more glamorous than ever because of the large number of musicians who took part, not just presenting a diverse culture with each region performing its own music, but also because of upholding the name Fajr.
Fajr means dawn in Farsi and refers to a 10-day period that led to the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This has been the reason to hold cultural events, including a theater, a film, and a music festival, going by the same name every year. And this is the final part of that trio, leaving the audience at awe with its unique performances until next year, when another edition of the FAJ Theater, Film, and Music Festivals will once again bring artists and enthusiasts together in the Iranian capital. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
That report brings an end to the International Bulletin for this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the U.S., a new policy by the Biden administration limits asylum access at the southern border with Mexico. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Los Angeles Times has covered this story and tells us more. The Biden administration announced a policy on Tuesday, 21st of February, that would limit asylum access for immigrants who cross into the United States without authorization and failed to apply for protections on the way to the southern border with Mexico. The proposal will not take effect immediately and will go through a regulatory process to allow public comment for 30 days. After that time, the policy is set to be in place for 2 years following its effective date. It is the latest Biden administration proposal to deter migrants from entering the United States without authorization and to bring down the number of migrants crossing the southern border with Mexico. The policy is being unveiled as the administration prepares for the expected end in May of Title 42, a Trump-era policy that allows border agents to quickly turn back migrants. "We are a nation of immigrants and we are a nation of laws. We are strengthening the availability of legal, orderly pathways for migrants to come to the United States, at the same time proposing new consequences on those who fail to use processes made available to them by the United States and its regional partners," Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said in a statement. The government had struggled to lower the number of crossings at the border before it decided to expand its use of Title 42 in January to expel Nicaraguans, Haitians, Venezuelans, and Cubans to Mexico. At the same time, the Department of Homeland Security allowed immigrants from those countries who had verified sponsors in the United States to enter the country legally. After the announcement, the numbers of unauthorized border crossings went down in January to their lowest levels in almost 2 years. Since Biden administration officials hinted at the effort in January, advocates have criticized the idea, saying it mirrors Trump's move to block asylum for those who crossed into the United States without authorization and did not seek protections in another country of their journey. That proposal was later blocked in U.S. federal courts. "We will sue if this administration goes through with a transit ban, just as we successfully sued over the Trump transit ban," said Lee Gallant, a senior attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU. On Tuesday, 21st of February, immigrant advocates were critical of the proposal and condemned the intentions of the Biden administration. "We're deeply disappointed to see the Biden administration announce what is effectively a ban on asylum," Sergio Gonzalez, executive director of the Immigration Hub, an advocacy organization, said in a statement. Sergio Gonzalez previously served on the Biden administration's transition team. "Asylum decisions are a matter of life and death. Denying people a fair chance to seek safety and freedom under U.S. law flies in the face of America's moral leadership on the protection of refugees and President Biden's campaign promise to rebuild a fair, humane, and orderly immigration system," he said. Lori Ball Cooper, Legal Services Director for the International Refugee Assistance Project, said in a statement that the move was unconscionable. "This asylum ban was illegal when the Trump administration proposed it, and it is illegal now. President Biden should restore full access to the asylum system immediately," she said. Chris Magnus, a former Biden administration official who led U.S. Customs and Border Protection before being forced to resign, said the new effort was confusing. "I'm trying to understand how we can authentically commit to our asylum laws and values, but then propose policies so inconsistent with those same values," he said. Biden administration officials, however, have said the new policy is not comparable to Trump-era policy because it would not categorically ban asylum and offers a way to gain asylum access at a port of entry. "This administration just won't allow mass chaos and disorder at the border because of Congress's failure to act," an administration official said on a call with reporters on Tuesday. "To be clear, this was not our first preference or even our second preference. From day one, President Biden has urged Congress to pass the comprehensive immigration reform and border security measures to ensure orderly, safe, and humane processing of migrants at our border." Under the proposal, immigrants who cross the southern border without authorization after traveling through a third country and have not been denied asylum in a country on their way to the United States would be forced to overcome a presumption that they are ineligible for asylum. Immigrants unable to overcome that hurdle would be liable to deportation unless they meet one of several exceptions included in the policy or clear a higher bar for protection in the U.S. asylum officers are expected to handle interviews of immigrants crossing the border. CBS News has also covered this story and tells us more. The Biden administration published a proposal on Tuesday, 21st of February, that would disqualify certain migrants from U.S. asylum and allow the government to deport them more quickly, saying the major policy shift is needed to curb unlawful migration at the southern border with Mexico. The regulations, which will not take effect until after the government responds to comments from the public, would render migrants ineligible for U.S. asylum if they cross the southern border illegally after failing to ask for humanitarian refuge in another country such as Mexico. Those unable to prove that they are not barred from seeking asylum under the rules could be quickly deported without a chance to see an immigration judge. The Department of Justice and Homeland Security, which oversees the judges and officers who review asylum cases, will give the public 30 days to comment on the proposed regulations before implementing them. The government told the Supreme Court earlier this month it plans to finalize the regulations by early May. Once they take effect, the rules would last for 2 years, subject to a review that could lead to their expiration, extension, or modification. If enacted, the rules would be a seismic change to U.S. asylum policy, barring most non-Mexican migrants from crossing the southern border into the United States, in between designated ports of entry from requesting refuge. U.S. law gives those on American soil the right to seek asylum, regardless of whether they entered the country without permission. The proposed regulations also represent a notable immigration policy pivot by President Biden, who campaigned on restoring access to the asylum system and overturning the hardline border policies of his predecessor Donald Trump. In 2019, the Trump administration enacted a similar regulation that also penalized migrants who crossed the United States' southern border with Mexico without first asking for asylum in a third country. That rule, known as the asylum transit ban, was ultimately struck down in federal courts of law. Advocates for asylum seekers said the proposed regulations are the Biden administration's version of the transit ban and have vowed to challenge them in federal courts of law. The last thing the Biden administration should be doing is replacing one inhumane Trump-initiated policy with its own version of another inhumane Trump administration policy, said Eleanor Acer, senior director for Refuge Protection at Human Rights First, a group that advocates for asylum seekers. The Biden administration has justified the proposed restrictions on asylum eligibility by pointing to record number of migrant apprehensions reported along the U.S.-Mexico border in recent years. U.S. border officials processed migrants over 4 million times in fiscal years 2021 and 2022. Biden officials have rejected accusations that they are reinstating a Trump-era rule, noting their proposal will have humanitarian exemptions, including for unaccompanied children. Those eligible for an exemption are migrants with acute medical conditions, those fleeing imminent and extreme danger, and victims of human trafficking.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone, and our heartiest congratulations to all. Today, on the auspicious birthday anniversary of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the younger grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, let us listen to a gem of a saying from the immortal martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. By my life, what is the Imam except the one who judges by the book, who upholds justice, who professes the religion of truth, and who devotes himself to the will of Allah?
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, moderation in work and worshipping. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of moderation in work and worshipping in the Islamic lifestyle. We have seen that in the Western life, we get busy in working, and the whole day we are working, working, and working. On the other hand, there are some people who are religious or practicing Muslim, as it has been said. So they try to worship, and they give less importance to the work. Whereas when we look at the Islamic texts, it tells us that we must have a moderate way in worshiping and working, there should be a balance between the work and worshiping. Now, the concept when we talk about the worshiping means that the performing of daily obligatory prayers, that is the first thing which we must do, and we cannot skip these things due to work. On the other hand, there are some extra things that we need to perform, or they are mustahabbat. So we have some people who leave the world for the akhirah, for deen, for the religion, and they do not give any importance to this world, and everything is the religion and the religious rituals or practices. On the other hand, there are some people who spend their whole life in this world, in earning, in this material world, and they spend their life for this world, and they ignore the religion, they ignore the religious rituals. Now, both of them are not on the right path, because Imam Kadhim alayhi salatu wasalam has said, "Laysa minna man taraka dunyahu lidinihi aw dinahu lidunyahu." He is not from us who has left the world for the religion, or he left the religion for the world. So both of them are not from the followers of Ahlul Bayt. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of moderation in work and worshipping. Imam Kadhim alayhi salam has said that the one who leaves the world for the religion, for his religion, or the one who leaves the religion for his world, he is not from us, he is not from Ahlul Bayt. Why? Because he is not following the moderate way. The person who follows the moderate way is the one who gets the success and the reward in hereafter. The final destination, the success, is for the one who spent his life in a moderate way, that when there was a time to work, he was working, and when it was the time to worship, he was worshiping. And he never mixed these two timings. Why? Because the person who is a mu'min, when he's working, he knows that this working is also worshipping. This work that I'm doing, the earning that I'm performing, the earning that I'm gaining, which is halal. If it is halal, this is a worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So he's not spending his time out of worshipping. On the other hand, where there we have the obligations, the obligatory prayers, he performs them on time as well. Therefore, it is necessary to have the moderate way, to not to exceed to the limits, to not to cross the limits that are being set by the Islam. Therefore, it is necessary that we have the balance between the world and hereafter. Why Imam has said that the one who leaves this world for dinihi, for the religion, is not from us, is because that this world is the place which will make my hereafter. This world, this material world, will help me to gain the rewards, to perform the good deeds, to get the power of following my religion. Therefore, I need to follow a moderate way, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Thank you.
In July 2022, the Stockholm District Court sentenced Hamid Nouri, a former Iranian official, to life in prison for what it described as grave war crimes when he was serving in the country's judicial system. Slamming the verdict as political, the Islamic Republic dismissed the charges as baseless and the trial as a travesty of justice. Nouri was arrested upon arrival in Sweden at Stockholm Airport in November 2019 and was immediately put in solitary confinement. A new round of legal procedures to review Hamid Nouri's case was held in Stockholm on January 11th. The most shocking point is that Nouri was arrested on false charges leveled against him by a terrorist group called the Mujahideen-e Khalq Organization, MKO. Meanwhile, the MKO is trying to whitewash itself from a cult with the blood of many innocent people on its hands into a victim, or even a hero that sacrificed itself for its country.
Coming to the court, it was huge relief for me because I just could get across the message of those people who were killed on those dark days. And also by following the path, by just doing whatever they wanted to do, they wanted to bring freedom and democracy to Iran. And just I'm following their path. That's something which can relieve me a little bit.
Strangely enough, during the prolonged trial, the Swedish judiciary system only allocated Mr. Nouri a few days to defend himself in court, which compared to the time offered to MKO plaintiffs was insignificant and unfair. But what kind of terrorist organization is the MKO exactly? And why is it so hated inside Iran? The terrorist organization is responsible for the assassination of at least 12,000 Iranians. Now, Sweden has become a safe haven for the terrorists. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, Iran became a country open to all tastes. Followers of all ideologies, from liberalism to Leninism, could write, talk, and hold meetings freely. Freedom of speech was in full swing. Against such a backdrop, the MKO, under the leadership of Masoud Rajavi, decided to pick up arms in a desperate attempt to take power in Iran. In other words, the organization was not preoccupied with academic or intellectual activities at all. So instead of competition with other groups in the political arena, they opted for an armed struggle, claiming indiscriminately the lives of thousands of innocent Iranians. The terrorist cult also targeted a great number of Iran's senior officials with the ultimate aim of taking power in the country. Although the aim was naive, it stripped the country of figures that could have played significant roles in the future of the republic. Just in one case, the terrorist group assassinated Ayatollah Beheshti, an outstanding Iranian figure who had played a significant role in the victory of the Islamic Revolution. At the time of his martyrdom, Ayatollah Beheshti was the Chief Justice of Iran, well known for his progressive ideas about democracy and human rights. He was the staunch advocate of this idea that the public have the last say. So the MKO didn't merely targeted a high-ranking official, but more importantly, removed a person who represented democratic values in post-revolution Iran. Even before the revolution, the MKO killed a number of American advisors in Iran. And in recent years, they have been a key element in the assassination of Iranian scientists in cahoots with the Israeli regime. In short, besotted with power, the MKO has shown no respect for human life.
Mujahideen have been linked closely to Israel. You have a report by two high officials from the CIA, which was publicized by the NBC radio in 2012, which said that the operations to assassinate the scientists and any other clandestine operations, terrorist operations inside Iran, were being planned or had been planned by the Israeli Secret Service and executed by members of the Mujahideen. So the Mujahideen have been working with the Israeli Secret Services ever since that time.
For all these crimes, the MKO was put on the EU terrorist list not many years ago.
The chairman of Security Commission of European Union made an approval of the involvement of Mujahideen in terrorist attacks.
That this organization is put on the terrorist list is a decision for all 15 member countries of the European Union, because such decisions are binding for all the member countries.
Now the bloodthirsty cult is trying to take power in Iran through subversive activities, and its leader has already called herself Iran's president-elect. The question is, why should the Swedish government work hand in glove with this notorious group, which has the blood of innocent Iranian civilians on its hands? Unwittingly or else, Stockholm is breaking the taboo of supporting terrorists and recognizing them as legitimate opposition groups. Will Sweden become a country where Daesh terrorists can file a complaint against Iraqi officials for imprisoning or executing them? The question is shocking, but isn't it exactly what Stockholm is doing right now? It's not hyperbole to say that Daesh is a progeny of the MKO, a group which initially launched a terror campaign in the country, killing as many civilians as possible, then disappointed to take power, fled to Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and helped the Iraqi dictator in his inhumane war against Iran. Even at a time when the Iran-Iraq war was coming to an end under the United Nations Security Council Resolution 598, the MKO again invaded Iran, hoping to capture at least western parts of the country. All in all, in one of the most absurd trials in recent history, the Swedish judiciary system, under the guise of advocating human rights, has become the mouthpiece of one of the most obnoxious terrorist groups in the world. That's why even other opposition groups outside Iran steer clear of the MKO because of its dark track record.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
While Ukraine is devastated by war and Europe is caught in an economic crisis, the United States is making a lot of profit from selling weapons to Ukraine. However, the majority of the American people are against the financial and military support of the Biden administration for Kiev. We've taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. English website of Al Mayadeen Television Network has covered this story and tells us more. Thousands of anti-war demonstrators took to the streets of Washington on Sunday, 19th of February, against the U.S. government's warmongering policies, urging the Biden administration to stop supplying arms to Ukraine and to disband the NATO military alliance. The biggest demonstration was held at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., a symbolically significant venue for American political activists as people participated in the Rage Against the War Machine national rally. The protesters at the rally, who held anti-war placards, called for peace talks between Russia and Ukraine and an end to US funding of military aid to Kiev. They also called for diverting the Pentagon budget to fund numerous domestic needs. The anti-war protesters also demanded the dissolution of the NATO military alliance, blaming NATO for horrors of war in much of the world. Nick Branagh of the People's Party and Angela McArdle of the Libertarian Party, who moderated the national rally, described the event as an opportunity by the organizers and the speakers from across the political spectrum of the United States to bring together the left and the right and end the war in Ukraine. Pacifist journalist and author Chris Hedges delivered one of the keynote speeches at the event. The Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, who was a foreign correspondent for 15 years for the New York Times, where he served as West Asia Bureau Chief and Balkan Bureau Chief for the New York Times, set the platform for the notable left-right speakers who would follow up in the national gathering. Veteran U.S. Congressman and former presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party, Ron Paul, was one of the speakers who spoke at the rally, stating that a simple way to stop the war was to end the Fed and to not send people to war unless they vote for it. Former U.S. Congresswoman and presidential candidate Tulsi Gabbard, who spoke, reminding the crowd of what caused her to run in 2020 and how there was no other candidate willing to talk about the dangers where this new Cold War and nuclear arms race would lead. Former Green Party presidential candidate Dr. Jill Stein was another speaker at the rally. Jill Stein called for slashing the Pentagon's enormous budget, arguing in her speech that even the $100 billion we are spending to support the war in Ukraine could help the nation solve a wide range of domestic issues. Jill Stein said, "This murderous military spending consumes resources desperately needed here at home by 70,000 people who die each year for lack of health insurance, for 500,000 homeless people on any given night out in the streets of America, for 33 million mired in student debt, 100 million in medical debt, and 22 million impoverished children, and so on and so forth." Former Congressman Dennis Kucinich, who fought for the Democratic nomination in 2004 and 2008, cited a bombshell report by Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Seymour Hersh to demand accountability from the U.S. government. Dennis Kucinich said, "In blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline, this government has used illegal and unconstitutional means to destroy the energy resources needed to protect millions of people in Europe during winter, and then to profit from its illegal actions by selling energy to Europe at a 4 to 6 times markup." Dennis Kucinich pointed out that the White House's greatest talent is to craft misinformation and disinformation to subvert the media and misuse it as an instrument to incite fear and hatred among our people, exiting partisan divisions at home through cross-politics and stirring ancient hatred abroad through lies, deceit, false flag operations and provocations which profane the very essence of democracy. At one point, comedian and political commentator Jimmy Dore went on stage. Jimmy Dore asked the crowd why the United States was sending funds to aid the pro-Nazi Kiev government when people in the United States itself are in dire economic straits and needed money to purchase eggs or other basic items for their survival. Similar demonstrations were also held in Bath and Westbrook, Maine, to protest the billions of dollars the United States is spending to arm Ukraine. Peace groups and other organizations of the rallies also called for dismantling of the NATO alliance and to slash America's military budget. China's Xinhua news agency has also covered this issue and tells us more. Hundreds of protesters on Sunday afternoon, 19th of February, slammed America's role of war machine in overseas wars at a rally before the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. Organizers said the anti-war rally was planned to protest against massive money funneling into Ukraine, as well as America's role in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. A statement said billions of taxpayer dollars are being torched at the altar of U.S. hegemony, the military-industrial complex, and a corrupt Congress. Jimmy Dore, American political commentator and media personality, spoke at Sunday's rally, echoing that America is corrupt. Jimmy Dore said, "Do you know we could end this war today through diplomacy, but our politicians want to enrich weapons manufacturers so they keep donating to them." Kat McGuire, a protester from New York City, told China's Xinhua news agency, "The overarching goal of this rally is to stop the war in Ukraine." Kat McGuire said, "People have to wake up. There's massive warmongering propaganda, and unfortunately, too many people have bought into it." Other speakers and protesters also lashed out at America's military-industrial complex, a powerful interest group made up of the military, private defense contractors, and politicians. The protesters then marched to the White House after the rally, chanting slogans like "No to NATO, No to War." Eric Reeves, a protester from Texas, said the military-industrial complex, which has a huge influence on Washington's decision-makers, is way out of control. He complained the U.S. government is not doing the will of the American people and making decisions without consulting us. U.S. President Joe Biden made an unannounced visit to Kiev on Monday, 20th of February, and pledged a military aid package worth $500 million, almost a year into the Russia-Ukraine conflict. The United States, by far the largest supplier of military assistance to Ukraine since the beginning of the war, also announced an additional $500 million aid package, which will include more military equipment and more weapons, like the anti-tank Javelin missiles, for Kiev. During his visit, President Biden vowed that Washington would stand with Ukraine as long as it takes.
Midstream.